Fearless Voyager Radio. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers, psychic phenomena and the unexplained, UFOs, extraterrestrial encounters, government cover-ups, alternative health care, new technologies. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Studio City, California, at the home of Charlie Lutz.
Actually,
you met Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in
1959.
Almost as soon as he came to the country.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, and how is it that you met him of all?
Well, I was taking a course in analytical psychology from Manly Palmer Hall, and one night this German came to the meeting, and he had a little clipping, and he said, I'm going to go hear this man, and he looks very good to me. So my wife Helen happened to be with me that particular evening, so she took a look at the clipping, and she said, he looks very interesting to me too, and she said, I want to go hear him. And I said, then why don't the two of you go?
And she said, so you weren't interested?
No. And she said, well, we are going, but you're going with us. And that's how I went to hear Maharishi, and he lectured at the Maskers Club in Hollywood, that's the Actors Club, and it was on a Thursday night, I remember that, and I think it was about the middle of May when this happened, and I wasn't overly interested because I had heard a lot of people talk about a lot of things, and but when I listened to him for about 5 or 10 minutes, all of a sudden I said, that's it, that's what I've been looking for. And it locked in. So after the meeting was over, I walked up to the platform, and it was just Maharishi on his platform, just sitting up there on deerskin, that was it. There wasn't a flower or anything else. But I walked up and I said, Maharishi, if I start to meditate, will I know about God? And he said, better than that, he says, I will teach you to experience God. And I said, fine, that's what I want to do. And that's where I started. So a week or two, a couple of weeks later, maybe a little longer, they wanted to build a meditation or an initiation room back at the Olsen's place. He was staying with the Olsen's, Helen and Roland Olsen. And he asked me one day, he said, you're in the construction industry, are you not? I said, oh, yes. And he said, would you go back there and see what they're doing and see if they're doing it right? So I went back, and they were trying to build the roof before they put the foundation in, so I straightened them out a little bit, and all of a sudden there was somebody standing beside me, and I turned around, it was Maharishi, and he said, you like to be with me? And I said, oh, fine and dandy, whatever, you know. And he said, no, I mean be with me. I said, yeah, it's okay, I'll go along that. And he kind of laughed, and he says, good. And that's where I really started with Maharishi. And this is about, two, 3 weeks, I would say, after the Maharishi arrived. And of course, there were people there that said that there should be some sort of an organization. If Maharishi was going to initiate people into transcendental meditation in the United States, it was incumbent upon him to have an organization. So everybody came with a different idea of what the organization should be. And the United States Meditation Society, the American Meditation, all sorts of names, and he'd say, good, good, good. We call it Spiritual Generation Movement. And this is what it became, and it was a foundation. So that was the first beginning, the first organization. Jack Hislop, at that particular time, was the first president. I had some assistant something. I don't remember even what it was. But shortly after that, in a matter of a couple, 3 months, I was elected the executive vice president to Jack Hislop. And we worked together for, I imagine, a couple of years there. And then one day he announced that he was resigning and leaving. So I became the second president of the, and also chairman of the board of the foundation and the organizational end of it. And shortly after that, Maharishi gave me, I guess, what's tantamount to an Indian title, world governor. So I was the first world governor of the movement. And I did travel all over the world with Maharishi. years, all around and around the world and all over the world and back and forth.
Did you leave your job at this point, or?
Yes. I had a unique situation, and that was that I had 5 weeks vacation time, sick time and vacation, amounted to 5 weeks, which I could take at one time, because in the construction industry, at least the part we were in, the great activity was from January to April. And I used to tell Mari, she don't plan any trips or anything until after April 15th, after tax day. And he'd say, okay. And then also the company, by that time between January and April, I had my quota made for the year. And he used to tell me, we don't want you to sell everything. We have other men here to want to sell also, you know. So I was in mostly in large projects and that sort of thing. But anyway.
So you'd make your quota, and then the rest of the year you would spend with Maharishi?
Well, not entirely. We'd go on trips. The vice president told me, he said, Charlie, don't sneak off on me. Come and let me know where you want to go. So I'd walk in the office and I'd say, Bill, I want to go to Greece. Greece? What are you going to do in Greece? I said, I'll find out when I get there. And so I'd take off for Greece or wherever it happened to be. But I always told him, as such, he said, when will you be back? And I said, well, Monday morning, such and such a time, or whatever the time was, and I always walked in the office at 8 o'clock in the morning on that morning, and it made him happy. There were certain things that made him real happy, and that was for you to be punctual, to be on time, and this sort of thing, and to keep your word. So he was very happy about it. So he told me, he said, I know you're with a Maharishi, and he said, but I don't mind you traveling with him. And he said, just let me know, and don't sneak off, and that's fine. And so that's what I did for quite a few years.
What happened to Jack? I think you mentioned something about Sai Baba, or?
Jack left the movement and ultimately wound up with Satya Sai Baba. And he represents him in North America. Still does at the present time. And he travels around the United States from one place to another. And I haven't seen him for quite a while, but that's what he's doing.
So we're with some of the forerunners of this new age then, at that point, if we're going to call it new age. I mean, it's had so many names.
Well, to begin with, I had been in the School of the Mysteries, and I had had instruction. I studied 7 years under Manny P. Hall, and I had had
other instructors. I'm not familiar with the School of Mysteries. Can you...
It's a mysterious school. somebody just appears one day. That is not out of thin air, but they just walk up to you and or attract your attention and say, you have been selected for the School of Mysteries. Are you interested? And naturally, it would be. I imagine some might not be, but no, I don't think so. If they ever approached you, you were ready to go into the School of Mysteries.
So you were approached?
Oh, yes. And so I started that. And that's a one-on-one situation. And it was... I should say that they taught the mysteries, and it's like everything else. Much is not revealed, but now we're coming into the present age that we're now in, actually, the age of Aquarius, when it's going to be known as the age of truth revealed. What used to be in the mystery schools will simply be taught openly. And I think maybe that's what I started doing several years ago, which sounded very way out in left field to most people. Not most, but to a lot of people, particularly in our movement. And but however, today, it's just the opposite. They really accept the truths and so forth as they are. So this new age, which is upon us, the age of Aquarius, this comet coming through here in the next week or two, actually announces the close of the Piscean Age and the beginning of the Aquarian Age. And of course there has to be tremendous changes that will take place. It's called Heaven on Earth, which Maharishi has announced, certainly, and has made very definite reference to and obeisance to and so forth, which is very true. This is what's going to happen. It's going to be Heaven on Earth, meaning simply peace. Peace and unbridled prosperity is what it amounts to. The homeless and the extreme, the billionaires, they're in the last days. Everything will come more into equilibrium, more into balance. Today we have tremendous extremes, and the extreme poor and extreme wealthy living simultaneously in the same surroundings and so forth. But that won't be in the future. It'll come more into equilibrium, more into being. And this is the new age that I guess everybody's quite familiar with, or certainly will be, if they're not at this present juncture.
Let's come back to the mysteries for a moment. Let's hear a mystery. What is a common mystery that was, let's say, revealed and will be revealed, let's say, or some of the things that you've been revealing to people?
Well, for one thing, which is simply that reincarnation is a fact of life. And this is a lesson world. We're here to learn the lessons of life. And on the other side, when we leave here, we're judged, actually, on our performance over here, as anybody would be if they were doing a job. So the only thing is, you're your own judge. And you're a very severe judge over there, because now you know the beginning and end of things. Over here, you don't. The last thing it happens to you before you're born here, your memory's locked off. So you don't remember over here.
Now, is there a way to open that memory? There are so many people that make claims like in, past life regressions and things like that. Is that an unlocking, or is that an illusion?
In some cases, it's it can be an unlocking, yes. When I first started in the to seek, there's a point of awakening, really, caused by different means and methods, obviously, for different people. But at the point of awakening, you become a seeker all of a sudden. Suddenly there's a desire to know, there's a desire to seek. What is this all about? What lies ahead? What am I really? And so forth. So then you begin to seek. Well, the important thing is that you seek in the right direction and you seek the right things. And you're very fortunate if you have good guidance. Of course, being married to Helen, she was psychic, was born as a psychic, and she pretty well knew if I was going in the right direction or going in the wrong direction, so I was very fortunate in that regard.
So you've had a lot of
support to me, yes,
to get you going in the right direction.
Yes, I pulled up in front of a little print shop one day, because I had an appointment up the street and I just parked there. Got out of my car and I walked up on the sidewalk, and a little man came out with a printer's apron on. And he said, "Do you see anything in the window that interests you?" And I said, "Well, I haven't looked." So I looked in the window and he said, "Come on in, I want to talk to you." So I went in and I said, "What is it you want to tell me about?" He said, "I have a manuscript here and I want you to take it home and read it." And I said, "Well, don't you want to know who I am?" He says, "I know who you are." And he said, I said, "Well, don't you want a deposit or something?" He says, "No. I just want you to read it and bring it back." And I said, "Okay, fine." Well, he was the right-hand man to Max Heindel, who was the guiding light of the Rosicrucian movement up until he passed away. And I had various things like this happen. All of a sudden, someone would just appear and open another door for you. And that's the way, until Maharishi came. In fact, I was walking down the street one day, and a man, one night actually, a man walked up to me, a very well-dressed man, and I had a little Cocker Spaniel with me. And he said, "That's a beautiful little dog." And I said, "Yeah, we're teaching him to cook." And he kind of laughed, and he said, "You know, great indeed is your good fortune." And I said, "How's that?" And he said, "There's a great master coming to the West." And he said, "You'll be very close to him." And he said, "Great indeed is your good fortune." And he turned around and he walked away. So I said, "It was the corner of a bank." And I said, "Well, where in the thunder does he know? How's he know all that? You know, he doesn't even know me." So I hurried around the corner, wasn't anybody there. So, I mean, you fill in the rest of the blank. But sure enough, a little bit later, I met Maharishi. So, as far as the School of Mysteries is concerned, there's always been a School of Mysteries. Because the truth, people would drown in truth, actually. And another thing, too, it had been totally misused. So most of that was suppressed, all down through the ages. The school of the Essenes, back in the time of Christ, it's a school of mysteries. And there's always been a school of mysteries, all the way up. Our founding fathers belonged to the Masonry and this sort of thing that the United States was founded. United States, you know, was always referred to as the land that would keep Thursday, long, long time before it was ever
conceived. Now, what does that mean?
The land that will always keep Thursday, Thanksgiving Day.
I see.
It's always on Thursday. And so there are a lot of mysteries, yes. Nothing mysterious, just that we didn't know about it. But the thing is this, until a person really begins to understand and to believe in reincarnation, he's not really subject to being much interested. That opens the door, in other words.
So that's the first step. As soon as you decide that there is a purpose to our existence and understand that this purpose is to do something, next comes all of the ideas about what should we be doing and why should we do them.
Right.
Because if this really is happening over and over again, then...
And suddenly you begin to realize that whatever you do, it has a karmic effect. It's karma means action. Whatever your action happens to be, it reacts. Because the whole of life itself is controlled by cause and effect. What you put into causation, plan on affecting. One way or the other. Good, bad, or indifferent. And so all these things... you wouldn't be a bit concerned with or interested in. And most people, for ages, people have lived for the grave, in other words. Many believing, maybe there's heaven beyond here. Back in the Middle Ages, when they were Christianizing Europe, people were told they were going to heaven. But they couldn't be told they'd be up there a short while and they'd be right back, you know. So heaven was given eternal status, which it doesn't have. It's still in the field of relativity. But
in other words, these people didn't want to hear.
They didn't want to hear they
that they were going to come back.
No way, no.
Right.
Once was enough for them. But the actual fact is, of course, this being a lesson world, so people say, well, if the human being is a divine creation, which a human is, then why all this? It's because he didn't have divine mind. So, had to come down to a dimension of opposites. Which is the third dimension. It's exactly what we're in. And it's the dimension of opposites. If you were created in a complete atmosphere of bliss, what would you know about anything else? You wouldn't be the least bit concerned, would you? So you wouldn't have what is called divine mind or all-knowing mind. So you'd have to acquire this.
So the purpose then of incarnating over and over again is to develop divine
ultimately
mind.
Ultimately to gain divine mind.
What would you say is the
cosmic mind?
All right. What would be some of the what are some of the qualities of the divine mind or the cosmic mind?
Well, as far as the human is concerned, that cosmic consciousness simply means that you have the ability to know all there is to know about any one subject at any one time. God, Almighty Father, the ability to know all there is to know about all subjects simultaneously. What they're discovering now is that the mind basically is like a computer. It's an enormous, vast computer, but we're just opening it up degree by degree, and that's what it amounts to.
So it's a limitless area that was once thought of as being limited.
Yeah, that's right. If there's any limit to it, nobody knows what it is. That's the unknowable. It's beyond our capacity to know that.
So divine mind is similar to enlightenment or cosmic consciousness?
Divine mind would be cosmic mind. There's cosmic consciousness and there's God consciousness. There's unity consciousness and there's Brahman consciousness and so forth. These are all levels of consciousness. Brahman consciousness simply says that knowing that, there's nothing left to be known. Experiencing that, there's nothing left to experience. So in essence, you can say that all humans are Brahman. That part's true. But for the majority of people, they're so busily engaged in the activities of life, trying to get along, maintain a status quo and so forth, that they never think beyond that. But then there's no blame for that. That's just where they are in evolution. What people don't realize is there's a myriad levels of consciousness on this earth. And various people in various levels of consciousness do certain things in certain ways because that's their consciousness. And they can't expect it to be a whole lot better, except they do improve as they go along in life. And that's growth, because the whole point and purpose of each life is to evolve or evolution. And it is hoped you would evolve, certainly. Now, if you run contra to the stream, which is called evolution, you go the opposite direction, then there's a lot to pay back, a lot to pay for. People in the drug business today, you wouldn't want any part of that karma. Gee, that's horrendous. That's beyond even anything you could conceive of. What you do to yourself is not too good for you, but it's nothing compared with what it is if you do it to other people. And certainly when you give them drugs and cause them to become drug addicts and this sort of thing, and you control billions of dollars because you're a drug baron and this sort of thing, that's a pretty hopeless situation. I'm not passing any judgment. I'm just saying I'm glad I'm not in any way connected with that.
So this evolution, does everyone eventually get the divine mind? I mean, is this something that we all, by virtue
that's
of...
That's the whole point and purpose of creation.
So the reason, so it doesn't matter how long it takes,
no.
Since time is no. Not has no bearing on this time-space, I guess, is really just a thought anyway.
Well, each period of creativity, you might say, is called a Manvantara.
Right, well, there's a long...
Age of man.
Right. The
311 trillion, 140 billion years.
Right, which is a long time. That's plenty of time, you would presume, for this group of people to go from... Where would you start?
The highest Godhead in relativity would be Brahma.
Right.
And Brahma's lifespan is 311 trillion, 140 billion years, but in his time span, that's 100 years.
Right, he has 100 Manvantaras, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now let's see, we have Kali Yuga, which is about 432,000 years,
right? 432,000 years, yes.
We are where in Kali Yuga right now? We're in the early stages of Kali Yuga.
Kali Yuga is the time when evil is rampant upon the face of the earth, which anybody can testify to today. However, we're coming now into a period, you might say, a moratorium.
That's what I was going to ask you.
A 2,000-year moratorium, so to speak, and it says in the Bible that the devil and all of his minions will be cast down into the bottomless pit, and everyone will be happy and so forth during this 1,000 years, and then he's loose for a short while and cast back down. What it simply means is that all negativity is suppressed, and everything will be more of a positive nature.
Now, why is this happening? Is it just kind of like a rest a minute from...
it's just a moratorium.
What happens during that period? Do a certain number of souls, or a certain number of souls, going to have a chance to really finish their evolution at this point, or are we looking at just again a moratorium?
There'll be a golden opportunity to gain a cosmic status during this 2,000 years. Also, this Earth, you know, it has to be fertile for you to come back here. Okay, we've driven the vibrations down where it's pretty hard for people of exceedingly high consciousness to come into this earth. And also, the doors were opened, you might say, in the lower levels that were never meant to be opened, and people of very, very low destructive consciousness have appeared on the scene. Well, that all has to go, that's all. And again, people of very high consciousness will appear. They say that in the very near future, children will be born that'll have a mentality that'll take humanity 2,800 years to catch up with. That's hard to believe. But it's going to be an age where things will just be happening constantly. New things will be coming in. If you talk to anyone that's connected with the computer industry, they'll tell you it's hard to keep up with the new innovations as they're constantly coming in. It's going to be this way in everything. People are now very concerned about what's going to happen to all these people on the earth in the year, 2000, this sort of thing. That'll all be regulated. And there's not going to be any mass destruction or anything of that nature, but people do pass away all the time. So if they pass away in greater numbers and they're not born back in as fast a number and so forth, that regulate the situation. So many things will be taken care of.
Why this 2,000-year hiatus, let's say, from Kali Yuga, or is it going to be more like Sat Yuga, or
2,000 years is the solar age of any particular.
So just
sign.
Because of the age of Aquarius.
Yes, the age of Aquarius.
So every 25,000 years, roughly, we have a hiatus, or is that true?
Well, as far as we know, but we just put it this way: we know about this one.
All right.
But basically what happened in the age of Aquarius.
People who are wondering, I guess the age of Leo was during the height of the three Egyptian dynasties, so that would be the age of Leo, as I recall, just for the people to get an idea of time. Mm-hmm. What are you familiar at all with what the last age of Aquarius would have been? Would that have been the last age of Aquarius, would that have been just before the fall of the Garden of Eden?
Turns about every 25,000 years.
I'm just saying, if to come back, if we were to look at...
You'd come back to Aquarius in about 25,000 years.
I'm saying. So about 25,000 years ago, we came out of the last age of Aquarius. Mm-hmm. This is a nice time, then,
right.
We're coming into.
It's a very opportune time, very much so. We're going to have new innovations, new inventions, new everything. Unbelievable in the next few years. The changes in the next 5 years will be so dramatic that people wouldn't believe it if you told them.
But isn't that true of each age?
No.
It's not.
The greatest invention for several thousand years was the wheel, you know. No. This is just a time now and the opportunity. Also, too, people now are supposed to have reached a status or a level whereby they are self-controlled and self-governed. In other words, the impingement right now, as far as human beings are concerned, is to master emotions. We have to become masters of emotions. We're the fifth race, and that's the fifth race is accountable for that, to master emotions.
The fifth race meaning what?
The race we're in.
All right, how do you derive the term fifth race?
Because we're the fifth race that's been born into this particular age in Manvantara.
All right. I mean, I guess I will accept that for right now. I just wasn't sure. What was the fourth race, for example?
They basically were Atlanteans.
Okay, so the Atlanteans, okay, that's what I was trying to establish. So the Atlanteans were the fourth race. Were the Lemurians the third?
Third, and also they blended into the fourth race.
All right, and then the second race was what? Do you know offhand?
They didn't even carry a title.
All right,
they were the mindless ones.
Ah, so we're looking at an evolution also with the races.
Oh, sure.
So are you saying that the fifth race is more evolved than the Atlanteans?
No, in a sense they are. In another sense they are not, because the Atlanteans were masters of nature.
Right, they were masters of nature.
Masters of nature.
Were they the ones who created basically what we have now as far as nature is concerned? If we look out and see the trees, if we see a banana tree, for example, it has no...
A lot of that came in the Aquarian Age.
All right, so what we're looking at then...
The Aquarian Age basically had a history of over 100,000 years.
Hmm.
But then again, they got into wrong activity. Being masters of nature, they misused their powers, is what it amounted to.
What were some of the things that the Atlanteans did that were positive, and how about a few that were negative?
Black magic was one thing they got into.
All right. Now, black magic meaning what? We always hear that
Okay, now they were masters of nature, meaning they had enormous powers. So the difference between white magic and black magic is usage. It's the same power.
Right.
It's how you use it.
Right.
If you use it for control, to destroy, to harm anyone, or anything of this nature, impinge anything upon them, that's black magic.
Well, now, were the Atlanteans a worldwide race of people, or were they a small group that was controlling another part of the world? I'm not really familiar with this.
No, they were Atlantis, as far as is known, it ran from about the boundaries of Canada, from the Grand Banks over to the Azores, and on down to the northern tip of South America. It's a pretty good sized continent.
Right.
It didn't go down overnight. It went down in degrees. Mm-hmm.
But how did they, but who did they misuse, or who did they control then? Or were they controlling each other?
Each other, for one thing, and misusing each other. And in Atlantis, they had what was called the black faces and the white faces. The white faces were the ones who had not gotten into black magic. The black faces were the ones that had. And the white faces actually were taken off. And they were moved to Africa, or what became Egypt. That's why there's no history to the beginning of Egypt. It just simply was. And
so those who did not either, okay, those who knew the power but used it for good, were shipped off.
They weren't shipped off. They were just offered to be moved, and they
oh, they offered to be moved.
They were they.
Or they wanted to leave.
Yeah.
They emigrated, or so to speak.
The offer was made to them to just get out of here. You know. So they all left. And
this would be a large part.
Which the baker and the candlestick maker went, so to speak.
So that's the story. The story of the 12. The story of the 12 in the boat. Is that what we're talking about, leaving Atlantis? There was a story of the 12 meaning the 12 different dharmas, so to speak, the names of the different types of positions people would take in society, the merchant, the high priest.
Yeah, all of it. Yeah.
Right. All right. Mm-hmm. So they leave and went?
They all went, yeah. The ones that had not gotten into black magic.
Okay.
And even some of the priesthood had gotten into it. Changing things, changing the structure of things.
Right, they changed the structure of nature.
Yeah, changed a lot of things, and where they're not supposed to. You know?
Was it like gene splicing, what we talk about now? Is that a?
Yeah, that they got into that too, and also, Atlanteans were missionaries too in different parts of the world, to the ancient Mayans and that sort of thing. Also, the American Indians. You know, the American Indian, when you ask him who God was, always said the Great White Father. And he said, one day the Great White Father will return. Well, here came the conquistadors and so forth, and Columbus, as an example, and they mistook him for the Great White Father who had returned. Quite a mistake, but which they were taking advantage of in no uncertain terms. As an example, the Atlantean missionaries had taught the Mayans to mine gold, or a certain segment down there, to mine gold, and they learned how to do that, but they had no use for it, so they roofed their houses with it. And of course they told the Spaniards, who they thought that God returned, about the fact they had mined this gold and they roofed their houses. The Spaniards went up to the mountains to see this, and they went crazy when they saw that. In fact, they were so greedy, they loaded their ships, way overloaded.
Right, sank.
First wave that came along, down went the ship. Right now, they're dealing with something that says probably several $1 billion worth of gold or something, the bottom of that ship, mm-hmm. And the insurance company wants some of the money or something. That's what happened.
Greed is interesting. So for those people who are wondering why the pyramids are similar in different parts of the earth, then we're looking at the presence of
Atlantean
influence. So Atlantis, of course, abused its power, or her power.
That's right.
And as a result, we have a lot of karma, I guess, going on then. Is the fifth race then the receivers of the karma from the fourth race?
If they were involved in that, yes. Those who were involved in it. Of course, the Atlanteans were basically the fourth race, and the fifth race was born out of the amalgamation of all of the various races in Atlantis. And that's where the white race came, the Aryan race, and which overran Atlantis, really. And that's the beginning of the fifth race. There was one group. The reason Atlanteans, they weren't as blameful as you might think, because they did not have the reasoning mind. They didn't have the ability to reason things out.
This is very interesting, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but
they worked mostly by emotion and instinct.
All right, now this is a good point, because when people think of Atlantis or the Atlanteans and think about all of this ability to control, because of our development of mind, we naturally assume that they had the same language and the same writing skills and the same things that we have. And yet what I think you're implying is that they didn't have that.
They were working more from a divine nature. We're operating from purely human nature now. They had a divine input. That's where all those powers.
So would they,
master of nature.
All right, would they look primitive to us, do you think?
No, not too primitive. No.
When I say look, I mean we think of houses and buildings and cars and energy and mercantile and television as being somehow evolutionary. Did they have things like that, or would it have been quite a bit different based on...
More rudimentary construction, but they would have like slate roofs and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They had some things that we haven't even acquired yet.
Things that you, what?
Like? They work mostly more with nature than we work. We're coming to that. Propulsion, this sort of thing. An airplane, as an example, works by brute force.
Mm-hmm.
But in time to come, there will be vehicles, space vehicles, you might say, or flying vehicles that will work in conjunction with the laws of creation.
So in other words, the way...
They harness the grids and so forth.
The way a plane works is that it forces itself through the air, and by using hydrofoiling, it rises up. That's, I guess, a primitive way to move.
Yeah.
Because you're working with friction and all of those things that are against the laws of nature. You're suggesting there's another possible way.
Oh, sure. If you harness the forces of nature, it's all there. Now, don't forget, we have been taking out of the earth everything that we want. In the future, we'll take it out of space. Of course, the human being, as far as the human is concerned, he draws a lot from space already. From the sun, as an example. Tremendous energy and all this sort of thing. Of course, you can become over-energized in a hurry if you go to the beach. But right now, as an example, is not a good time to be sunburned because you're getting far more ultraviolet rays than you were getting before. Because the earth is now in the process of raising its own vibrations. It has to come up too, you know.
So the earth is a living organism, a living, breathing organism,
right,
that is also growing.
Also.
And what are we seeing with the earth? So are you saying that, for example, this greenhouse effect...
We've nearly destroyed it, that's what you're
saying. Okay. The greenhouse effect...
That has to be restored.
Is that a result of something that we've done, or is this part of the earth raising its vibrations? Well, I'm sure they're tied together somehow.
Both are factors, but the greatest factor is simply the earth changing.
So the earth changes. What is it, what does that mean? How do we... Does it change its crust?
Well, it changes, it raises its own vibration, yes. It becomes more etheric than it was.
So astronomers would call that heating up, like a star.
Yeah, you call that.
What happens to the beings? Do they also change etherically?
They heat up to that degree.
Oh.
No.
For example, I mean, there were those who would say that the Lemurians were vibrating at a faster rate.
It changes more into light, is what it amounts to. Just like the human blood eventually changes from blood heat to blood light. And the more highly evolved, I won't get into all that, but the more highly evolved you are, the more you run toward light.
Well, why can't we get involved in that?
Well, you just did.
Let's talk about it. What does an evolved being run like, or how does it work?
Well, the physical body has to become more tenuous. The physical body has to become higher and higher evolved and more purified.
All right.
Of course, the purification of the physical body lies in the nervous system, and the nervous system has to be purified, which simply is another way of saying what rate are you vibrating, because all is vibration. Everything resolves back to vibration and beyond that electricity. But anyway, as far as the human is concerned, whatever your degree of purity is in your body, which is also a level of consciousness or a state of consciousness, determines the rate you're vibrating. So the more purified you are, the faster you vibrate.
What about the physical? Can we physically account for this change, or is it subtle? Is it subtle?
You're aware of it.
I mean, because, for example, when Jesus, for instance, appeared to Thomas in that story in the Bible after
the resurrection?
Right, or somewhere during that period. Everyone thought it was an astral body because he supposedly passed through the wall. But wasn't Jesus the one who said, "You can touch me," which supposedly indicated that this was not astral, but somehow between physical and astral?
There was one point there where Christ said, "Don't touch me."
Oh, yeah, all right.
And because it was.
But he asked, remember he said to Thomas, "Thomas, you can touch my wounds and see that they're still there."
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What body would that have been?
That was the resurrected physical body. But then later on, he was in his light body. And a lot of people said, well, you know, he just rose up into the sky. He just raised the vibration and disappeared, that's all. He went into a different dimension. See, everything has this dimension, and that's according to the spectrum you're in. And also, we're rising into a higher spectrum than we're in now. We run from red to ultraviolet, but we're moving beyond that.
So we'll be able to see then in another part of that spectrum if we're raising into that spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Eventually.
Everything that we know or understand, or not everything, but most of what we know and understand, is visual. So as vision changes, so does everything else then.
Right, sure it does. In other words, you don't believe anything unless you see it, taste it, or touch it. And of course, everything that's beyond that, we don't see, because it's beyond our vibratory rate. But one thing about transcendental meditators, as an example, and other people too, various paths, if they raise their own vibrations, then they begin to see beyond, certainly. They begin to know things that are beyond. They begin to feel things that are beyond. They have all the sensations, but they're beyond what we know in the
classical sense.
Physical.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would we look for a general change like this in the age of Aquarius then? Is this another thing we're talking about? Or is this something
It's not going to be any mass change overnight. Most will change. But like everything else, you come out one by one, individually. They come into a cosmic status one at a time.
So a whole group, well, you're saying a whole group doesn't jump into
cosmic phase. No, it depends where you are in evolution, and it depends a great deal, too, on the substance of your nervous system. In other words, how fast are you vibrating and this sort of thing, or how purified is the body.
So we can look forward, for example, to a group of people who have developed a major change in their nervous system, but not the overall population of the world.
No, not at all, not at all. Religions will exist just the same as they always have, only they'll be on a much higher tone, much higher level, because it'll be truth revealed. Much has not been revealed in the Bible. And strangely enough, the Bible is written in the esoteric and the exoteric.
Which means?
Exoteric means that the truth is revealed, but it's all written in symbology. So unless you had the key to the symbols, you wouldn't understand, because the exoteric reads like history, whereas the esoteric has a very definitive meaning, but that's the meaning that's not readily known.
So the Bible is an exoteric...
Exoteric and esoteric.
Oh, it's
all
mixed.
All scriptures.
All right.
All scriptures that way. But now, this is why I say the age of truth revealed. All this, little by little, is revealed, you see.
What it really means. In the new age, there's no symbology. There's no exoteric.
No, there's no need for it, you
we
see.
Just,
what I mean?
Now, what was the need then? Why was it written that way?
Because many would have misused and taken advantage of it, retarded evolution.
So we're back to the fact that we can't know something until we're
ready to know it. Ready for it.
So the age of Aquarius.
The strange thing is now, if you tell someone a higher truth, it goes in, so to say, in one ear, not the other. Then again, if they come to a lecture, and you're lecturing on some higher subject, they just fall asleep. There's a woman came one time, and she had a friend who was a very well-known movie director, and she wanted him to hear a lecture, so he came to lecture to hear Maharishi. He fell sound asleep in about 2 minutes. And I told her if she was very upset, and I said, well, don't be upset. I said, that's the best rest he's had in a long time.
Right.
That's a deep rest.
So how, coming back to just to something that bothers me once in a while, how is it that the Atlanteans could misuse something? I always thought...
Because the human being always has free will.
So you are saying something that I thought, for some reason, that you couldn't develop your nervous system to a very high point without having given up a certain amount of, let's say, negative influence. You're saying that you could develop to a high point and then come back to negative influence?
You could.
This is what the...
But the point is you wouldn't.
Then how did the Atlanteans misuse?
They didn't have that consciousness, really.
Okay, that's what this is about then. They had the power.
They had the power, but not the consciousness.
But not the consciousness.
And
so now,
the reasoning mind.
All right, so now we're going to have the power,
the consciousness, and
the reasoning mind.
Right, and also master of emotions.
Now this is what happens.
Emotions have gotten into a lot of trouble, a lot of problems.
Right.
Something now this, they had to master.
This is what happens then in the age of Aquarius.
Mm-hmm. Distinctly.
How does the age of Aquarius, which is kind of a hiatus from Kali Yuga, how does that differ from Sat Yuga?
Sat Yuga is just simply the highest that there is. That's pure bliss.
Now, the power that we have, the change in
evolution. That's the golden age, so-called.
Right. The evolution, the heaven on earth, so to speak, that happens during the age of Aquarius, during Kali Yuga, is not the same then as Sat Yuga? Or is it a taste of Sat Yuga?
It would resemble very closely Sat Yuga.
Oh, it does resemble closely. Is the quality of life then very similar?
Very much higher, yes.
Not higher than Sat Yuga, though?
Not a higher Sat Yuga, no.
But similar?
Mm-hmm. Very similar.
Let's talk about...
In other words, if you have one extreme, which is a Kali Yuga, now you're going into another extreme, so it'd be just the opposite of, so it'd be like Sat Yuga.
So we've got 2,000 years... And then what?
2,000 years of heaven on earth.
And then what? Back?
Slowly you go back into the other. You wouldn't just drop in there all overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But it would never be as low as it was, ever.
You're saying that Kali Yuga will not be as bad as it has been?
No.
So the beginning of Kali Yuga was really worse than the middle of Kali Yuga, let's say?
Yes.
Because there were those who thought that the beginning of Kali Yuga was nothing like what Kali Yuga...
We went into Kali Yuga at about 3,000 BC, so we've been in 5,000 years.
Right.
When Lord Krishna was on earth, and he was an avatar, and he was dispatched by a hunter with a bow and arrow. But anyway, that's when we moved into Kali Yuga.
All right, that's the story of the Bhagavad Gita. We've got 427,000 years left of Kali Yuga. That's plenty of incarnations.
Right.
What happens to the person who, quote, learns the lessons? Do they wait and maybe incarnate in Sat Yuga, or?
It wouldn't be necessary. If you gain a cosmic status, then you escape the wheel of birth and death. Now,
but isn't this fun too? I mean, can't we enjoy this?
In a sense, yes. But then again, what lies beyond is so much greater that is like being in kindergarten. And so everybody wants to be free, you know, and totally so. We're confined in a human body and all that sort of thing. And ultimately it's not necessary. If you want a body for some reason, then create your own body, what have you not. But the ultimate thing is to gain a cosmic status. This is what's being offered now in the world, that you can, through transcendental meditation. And transcendental meditation, the uniqueness of transcendental meditation is that you're able to transcend the field of relativity and to begin to infuse the absolute into the relative.
How is that different from other forms? What makes it so different?
They don't transcend the field.
So, for example, what do they do?
They go to a very subtle level, which is a level of quietude, great rest, peace, harmony, and this sort of thing. But it's not transcendental. And transcendental, you go into the field of the transcendental, which is the field of the absolute. Now you begin to infuse that into the nature of the mind and the body. And little by little by little, it's a superior energy being translated into inferior energy, or introduced into inferior energy, so it eventually overpowers inferior energy. That's one way of describing it. And that's the cosmic status. Now, you're affixed to the wheel of birth and death, or called the wheel of necessity, or the 12 labors of the soul, any way you want to term it. There's the three ways you can do it. And many try to outstrip the wheel. You can't outstrip the wheel. You have to reverse yourself, go within yourself and reverse yourself, then spin off the wheel. The only way you can do it. The only way you can do it. And
is that now, would that be called enlightenment?
Yeah. All right. Once you had reached that point, that's enlightenment. That's a cosmic status. Meaning simply this, you can no longer die.
Or at least you no longer feel that you're so attached to the body that when it dies, you're gone.
You reach a status, and what happens is, at a given point, you just step aside of the body. Whereas death, as we understand death, is a process of extraction. It's entirely different. It's a process of extraction.
All right, so instead of it being taken from you, you step away
just
from
step
it.
Step aside of the body.
All right.
Because the body was just a vehicle.
Charlie, I know that you're very busy. I want to thank you for being on the show. I hope that I could come back here again and do another show with you, and we could take up with some other ideas. I've just been so excited. I appreciate you took the time to be on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope it serves a purpose.
Oh, it will. Thank you very much.